Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, we visit with Mr. Greg Drake, Ag and Natural Resources Agent in Butler County, Kentucky. And as always, we'll wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Well, hello, everybody.
Hey, Jay.
Hello, Jay.
How is David and Vicky and our guest Greg Drake doing today?
Oh, good day, man. It's a good day to be here with you guys.
We're on the right side of the soil, as my grandfather used to say, so that's always a good day.
That's right. The weather's pretty good outside. We're recording in Des Moines, Iowa. We had to drive 8.5 hours to talk to somebody that's only a couple of hours away from us. But Greg was nice enough to step in and help us out, and we needed another show, and be a good time to visit about some programs that he's got going on.
That's exactly right. You know, we're up here at the National Ag Agents Conference. It's moved around every year. It's in a different part of the year, this different part of the country every year. But this year it happens to be in Des Moines, Iowa. And as David mentioned, the weather is perfect. When I walked out this morning, I don't know what it was, but it was nice.
Mm-hmm.
A guy said earlier, he said he left Georgia and flew up here, and he wondered where spring went. He said it was up here.
Said he found it.
Yeah, it's crisp. You know, they told us it was liable to be hot in Iowa, and I'm not sure they know what hot is, if this is hot in Iowa, because this is all right. But they sure do grow a lot of corn up here.
Don't they, though?
I could get by fairly well in these temperatures just about year-round.
Yeah. So. When we was walking down the hall, I guess it was yesterday or last night for the opening ceremonies, and they had all the banners, you know, and it was, we're nationally number one in corn and number, you know, and they was number one in several things.
Yep,
and so it truly is an agricultural state. That is very evident from the drive in. But
I think a guy told me this morning when we were setting up our podcast stuff, and he was telling me that they've got more hogs than they got people.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I bet they do, because somebody's already told me that as well, too.
Yeah.
Yep.
I know years ago when the hog-corn ratio was a thing that they used to determine how many hogs you needed, and they based it upon corn prices, because corn was a static thing. They knew how much corn they were going to have every year. And if prices for hogs were a certain amount, it went into hog feed. If hogs were down, corn was up, it went into other things. So.
Yep.
It's a very beautiful state, a lot of row crop. We're in a part of the state where there's a lot of row crops for Kentucky, and this place certainly has that. So
last night I was talking to a farm management specialist here for Iowa State, and he said if you'll go 20 minutes north, you know, every mile there's a road, they're all in squares, they're 640 acres, and it's all corn.
Square mile.
Everything is corn, and that's kind of hard for me to grasp. They plant with 48 row planters there. They have a 24 row planter to plant the end rows. And we have, you know, we've got some very good operators in our country. But in Butler County, 24 row planters will catch it. And most everybody's got a 6 row planter in the shop to replant with, or plant little creek bottoms and branch bottoms.
Mm-hmm. Places you can't get equipment.
That's right. But they plant their end rows with 24 row planters, so the big planters don't have to slow down. So I'm getting a real education on nationwide corn production here. And, you know, we all live in grain counties. We all work with very progressive, very strong grain farmers. But their issues are different here.
Yep.
You know, everybody's got their issues, but their issues are different. And it's great to come to these National Ag Agent meetings and see the scope of agriculture.
Absolutely. And how they differ. And it just happens to be, like you all have already said, here it's a lot of the crops that we grow as well. But there's differences, you know, like you said, differences,
you know,
too.
You think about today, we've sat down and recorded three different podcasts with three different folks and three different types of agriculture. I mean, the guy from Florida was talking about peanuts and cotton and, you know, tropical plants and different things of this nature. The guy from Georgia was talking about beekeeping and how big a business that is around their area. But we've all got a lot of stuff in common, but we're not all the same, and the problems are not the same. It's exactly what Greg was talking about. The problems are not all the same. So it's interesting to learn. To me, it's interesting to learn how people handle some of the same problems and then see what the different problems mm-hmm. that they have to handle.
We worked with a guy years ago as an ag agent, Lincoln Martin. He's retired, still with us, but he's retired from extension work. His father lived in Iowa, and Lincoln used to come up here and visit him. And I actually went and visited him a couple times with him when we were traveling. The county he lived in, and I forget the county name in Iowa, produced more bushels of corn than the entire 8-county purchase area in western Kentucky produced. So it's not just acres of corn, but the bushels per acre a phenomenal difference. Mm-hmm. They measure organic matter in their soil up here in feet. Rather than in inches like we do.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a different operating world. I know years ago I worked for a company that did independent testing when I was in college. And you see all these fact checks on chemical jugs and whatnot that says independent research says. Well, that was one of the companies that I worked for. We come up here and would dig trenches in an irrigated cornfield with a backhoe, put in guttering systems, and then they'd go to irrigating after a spray, and we'd catch that runoff and then take it back to lab in Kentucky and test it. And we would dig sometimes 6-foot trenches so you could get down and walk around in them, you know, and it'd just be black from no soil profile change at all. It'd be black all the way to the bottom. So
different ball game up here.
It definitely is.
I'll say one other thing about something that I've learned. I was talking to a county agent from West Texas, an hour south of Lubbock, and I asked him what the main thing they did in his agriculture was, and it's cotton.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so there are 40,000 acres of row crop in Butler County. We're a large landmass county, but we were a coal county, so a lot of our upland soil was stripped. But 40,000 acres will catch it for corn and bean production in Butler County. He said they'll plant 330,000 acres of cotton in his county.
Yeah.
All of it. It's 95% row crop ground. There's no grassland. And all they do is cotton. That just boggles my mind.
Yeah.
'Cause we're a very diverse area. Even though Butler County is a grain county, we've still got everything that, you know, the typical farm picture. You know, we still raise a little bit of all of it in the county.
Yep.
There in West Texas, they raise cotton. It's just fascinating for me to visit with him.
Greg Drake is our guest today. He's the ag agent in Butler County, Kentucky. Greg, won't you tell just a little bit about yourself and how you come to Extension? We've worked a lot of years now together. Talk a little bit about your home operation and agriculture in Butler County.
Okay, well, it's good to be with y'all. I enjoy doing these kind of podcasts and the importance of media and talking about agriculture. I came from a farm family. I was raised in Butler County. My parents were full-time farmers, kind of the picture of the nuclear family that you would imagine or that we all kind of grew up in. We raised corn and soybeans, beef cattle, hogs. When I graduated from high school, we had 60 sows. We pigged them out in the woods, and we chased pigs all the time.
Ooh.
We didn't have hog floors.
That's nothing fun about that at all. I've done that. It's not anything fun at all.
My sister and I'd get off the school bus, and we'd chase hogs till dark a lot of days. So I grew up in it naturally. Grew up driving tractors and farming with 4020s and 1086 Internationals. And when I went to school at Western Kentucky University, majored in agriculture, studied agriculture, and worked for the Miles family in Owensboro for a couple of years, was a crop consultant there, learned about the retail agriculture business. I probably learned as much there in them 2 years as I have all the rest of my time continued, because we were knee-deep in all aspects of agriculture. Went to the Extension Service in 97, and I've been the Butler County Ag Agent ever since. I've been very blessed in that we've had a good solid staff there in our county to do a lot of good agriculture and economic development. 4-H, my 4-H agent's been there for 36 years, so he's taken people that he took their grandmother to 4-H camp now. He's been there that long, so we've got a solid foundation in agriculture and 4-H and home ec in our Extension Service. We have a diverse group of things. I'm like a lot of the county agents in the state. I'm liable to be talking about sick garden tomatoes one day and then going looking at a weird malady in corn the next day. And my philosophy's always been that, you know, that one lady, that her tomato plant's just as important to her
That's right.
A field of corn is to a full-time farmer. So it's always fun. It's always a challenge, and we all have to prioritize our time. But we're serving good people there in Butler County, and I try to stay busy helping them.
You know, I've made the joke along the way when it comes to all the different producers and homeowners that we work with of no taxpayer left behind. And in Kentucky, where our extension services are supplemented by county tax dollars, that holds true. And that lady with that, you know, tomato plant behind her house is paying property taxes just like everybody else, and making sure that she gets the service she needs is giving her the access to your office and your programs that the big farmers use as well.
Absolutely.
And I always, to that same point, when we do our private applicator trainings, as each of us do in the wintertime, that's one of our responsibilities, is to make sure that our farmers get that certification that they need to be able to buy and apply the products that they need, and we do those trainings. And I always try to convey a message to those folks to just – be aware of your surroundings. Look around you before you start spraying, and that when you go in there and pull in that field, just look around, because I promise you that garden that's in that lawn yard beside you that's important to whoever has that. And so just remember to take a look and see what's around you, because that holds true on that side of it too. And as we've said many times, you know, farmers are the most environmental people around, you know, and sometimes we just need a little reminder to say, hey, just take a look before you start, you know. And but working for Extension, it makes it fun, because we do get to work with a lot of people. We get to be involved in a lot of things and help people solve some mysteries on what's going on, and sometimes we have to go a little further and have to ask those specialists too. So it's a good system.
Greg, I know you've been around a minute. 1997.
Yeah, that's
model.
A fair thing to say.
Talk to us a little bit about some of the big changes that you've seen in your career, and it can be with Extension or it can be with agriculture or whatever. But what are some of the changes that you've seen since 1997?
Well, I'll start with the chemical management. Vicki talked about going out on calls where we have drift or something, getting gardens and grapevines and rose bushes. You know, when we started, farmers were still killing weeds with Bazagran and Blazer and a Fusilade and Post and things. And then for 20 years, all we had to do was spray Roundup.
Mm-hmm.
And all of our crops were resistant to Roundup. So, you know, I remember well where we would have one chemical not get cleaned out of a spray applicator real good, and the custom applicator come through and do some damage to crop, and trying to figure out what it was, what might be done about it. Is the crop going to live or die? Can we go back and replant? We hadn't had that for a long time, but that seems like it's coming back now. You know, we're having to put clethodim back in spray mixes to kill grass, and seen a lot of change in chemicals. Of course, the yield. I'll tell one quick story beforehand. When I came back in 1997, I had been around Roundup Ready beans. They were commonly used in Owensboro, fairly used in Butler County, but I had a farmer. He'd planted his planter wouldn't shut off. The row clutches didn't work, so he planted everything around and around and around. He'd been planting Roundup Ready beans, and he didn't really believe that how it worked. Great guy. He didn't believe how it worked. He ran out of beans. He went back and got a couple of bags of something that he just had. So right in the middle, they were not Roundup Ready beans that he planted. So, of course, when the feed mill went and sprayed them, it worked like a charm on all the Roundup Ready
beans.
Except
for the ones in the middle.
And the ones in the middle was dead. And yeah. But I always think about that in progress. And yeah. I can see that in my mind. Well, it was no mystery to me why the beans were dead. And he learned that Roundup Ready technology
actually worked.
It worked.
Absolutely. Yeah. And another thing probably is yield and equipment size. When I started in Butler County, or when I came back to Butler County to work, even big farmers were hauling grain on tandem trucks, F600 straight trucks and tandem trucks. A guy that had three tandems was a big operator, moving a lot of grain.
Yep.
And now you'd almost go blind looking for a tandem truck, even on small farms. Mm-hmm. So you just don't see that. And that changes the dynamic of everything, because where you could back an F600 in and unload corn into a little bin, you can't get a 38-foot hopper bottom.
Well, in that little bin, that's exactly what I was fixing to ask, is what is grain storage like on farms in Butler County? Is that something that's changed any at all, or
yeah,
quite a bit?
Yeah, we've seen, the grain bin storage has to rise with yields. And I think in our county it has outpaced increases in yields because of the pressure and as the farms have grown. And in Butler County, we have 300 bushel corn ground, but an early rise in the fall can make that zero bushel mm-hmm. corn ground because we have backwater. Yep. So the guys have built bins to speed harvest, big drying systems to accommodate yield. And if you just had 500 acres of corn, you could get it out before the backwater. Mm-hmm. If you have 3,000 acres of corn, even with bigger equipment, you better be able to get it out to the field and get it dried and beat the backwater. So we've seen an incredible increase in that. And as I look back, just the size of the farmstead, we should have started out on another 5-acre plot, adding mm-hmm. a bin here and a bin there and mm-hmm. trying to put a leg up in the middle. It's caused some kinks and some heartburn sure, with
yeah.
folks.
A lot of planning has to go into that. But I'm like you. I've seen that change quite a bit on farms. David and I have talked about it. We both live in a county where there's a substantial amount of on-farm storage. We both work in counties where it's not non-existent. There's just not near as much of it as where mm-hmm. we both live. And that's something that, as a harvest aid, having a place to dump corn right on the farm means not sitting in that long elevator line or not making a drive to an elevator, at some point during the harvest. So,
a lot of guys, a lot of our people will go to the Farm Bureau Convention in December, first week of December. It's always been first week of December. Mm-hmm. And the ones that are still home harvesting don't have as much on-farm storage because mm-hmm. they've waited on the elevators. Elevators get mm-hmm. full, trying to get trucks to deliver it. So,
and you're waiting for it to dry down too, because right. a lot of times it's too wet, they can't get in there because they don't have any way to dry it.
That's exactly mm-hmm. right.
To me, that's the big advantage of having that system at home, is being able to combine corn, shell corn when you want to, rather than when you need to or when yeah. you have to.
Yep.
So, one of the things that I've seen too that's changed is just the number of varieties that's out there now. I mean, back in our Miles days that you referred to, I used to, and I'm sure you did too, when you was working there, you could rattle off every variety that, particularly corn or soybeans, we could rattle those off, and now I wouldn't even begin to. And part of that is too that I'm not working in it the same way. Those have really changed a lot over the years too. And not just the technologies that's in the bag, but just,
yeah. When we worked for the Miles family, I don't know, probably half the corn in Davis County was Pioneer 3165.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And, them days is long gone.
Yep. And 3394.
Yeah, 3394.
I commented to Vicki, we actually on the way up here saw a Pioneer sign.
Yeah.
And I said, that's the first Pioneer corn sign I've seen anywhere. And I'm not bashing any corn companies, but we just don't see them in our area like we used to. Some other varieties have come on and made some changes genetically and are a little better.
Was that in Missouri on your way, or was it? Yeah, I saw actually quite a few Pioneer signs the route that I took,
yep.
and then a small Pioneer looked like probably was a seed cleaner or distribution mm-hmm. point, something, wasn't a very big building, but had Pioneer sign on it.
Yeah, we saw some seed corn. I'm not sure exactly what company it was, but mm-hmm. we saw some field that was laid out for seed corn.
Right.
So, yeah.
And Vicki, I'll tell you another change that you mentioned that about the corn varieties. We've had two fertilized dealers in Butler County, the Green River Feed Mill and Drake's Farm Service, which causes a lot of confusion in Butler County. They're county agents of Drake and one of the farm services of Drake, but I've never been to a family reunion with any of them Drakes down there. That's the way I explain it. I've never been to a family reunion.
Yeah, that's a good way to
with any of them. But a couple years ago, I guess this is the third year they've spread out of it, the folks at Drake's built probably the most modern fertilized building, at least in our part of the world. They can hold an uncanny amount of fertilizer. It comes in on hopper bottoms and goes up a leg and then gets delivered to whatever bay. And when they did the upgrade, they couldn't keep up. They couldn't keep up with spreading fertilizer with the big farms. Mm-hmm. You know, going to a field trying to stay in front of 12, 16, mm-hmm. or 24 row planters is different than when you're trying to spread in front of 16, or excuse me, 6 and 8 row planters. Mm-hmm. So Denny took the leap a few years ago and built this fertilized facility. They never stop loading. They never stop loading buggies or trucks or whatever it is. Fertilizer comes in on one place and goes out on the other. It's all done digitally. They start the blender from the loader, and it's a whole long different way from the mile stores that we used to work at.
That's right.
But the efficiency that brings, mm-hmm. not having to stop and get out of the way while they're getting a load of DAP in. Yeah. And then everybody go back to getting blended. And then by the time you're mm-hmm. there with your buggy to get a load of fertilizer, you know, here'd come another load of fertilizer, and we'd have to stop and wait till they got that unloaded. So I've seen a lot of demand for efficiency, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. it is hard for the farm suppliers to stay in front of these large grain.
That's right.
Of these large grain guys. And then when you throw in buggies, and a lot of around us, a lot of the companies have quit dealing with buggies, but Drake still has them as a service to our farmers. They've got about 20 fertilized buggies. So if you're in the buggy line, you like it that they're moving you out in about 10 minutes instead
That's
of,
right.
you know, in the old days, if you was 5 deep to get a fertilized buggy blended, you might be there for an hour and a half.
Mm-hmm.
So that efficiency has come a long way in Butler County agriculture as well.
Well, and on that same line, just how our farmers have grown, and like you had said, the equipment's much larger, the way it's operated is different. But you know, we've said this many times on this podcast, but what used to take, you know, a long time to get your crop planted, now you can do it in a matter of days. And I mean, and we're not talking these small farmers, these big farming operations can get their whole crop planted quick because of that bigger equipment and more efficient and technologies that allow them to do that.
Yeah, and as farms grow and the width of the machinery grows, you know, the same amount of days to plant are there, and maybe they're worse. I don't know. It seems like you got to have everything ready, and if it gets dry, you better be running around the clock. Because we're liable to get a 3-inch rain and be out of the field for a mm-hmm. week. So it has been incredible to watch the grain farms scale up to be able to get, you know, because we've got some farmers that for a lot of their career farmed 900 acres, 1,000 acres, mm-hmm. and now they're planting 6,000 mm-hmm. acres. Mm-hmm. So to watch those guys scale up and meet those challenges has really been impressive.
That's right. And to get it out of the field, too, in the fall.
Yeah, I talk a lot on a radio station show that I do quite a bit. That's one of the biggest things that has changed thus far in my career is the amount of time that it takes a farmer to turn a crop around, whether it's getting it in the ground or getting it out of the field, either one. The amount of time has just – the acres have gotten larger and larger, and they've become more and more efficient and shrunk that down.
I cut a yield contest in the Ohio County side of the Green River Bottoms a few years ago on Jared Brown, and we were shelling 12 rows of corn, just not wide open, but was bringing in like 285, 295 bushel corn, and it was crazy. I mean, they were loading a semi. It seemed like he was loading a semi every 5 or 6 minutes, and you know, mm-hmm. you can get a lot of crop out of the ground with the machinery that these boys have. Mm-hmm. They just have to be able to keep it all tuned up, have good dealer support to keep the computers working, and it's incredible. And something else that's kind of cool I want to talk just a little bit about in Butler County, we've got a producer, Mike Martin. He's a very progressive forage producer, and they have brought in a square bale bundler. I just got to see it work a couple of weeks ago. They square bale the hay like you always do, and then drive around with this thing, and it makes 14 bale bundles mm-hmm. all tied together, kicks them out, and it looks like a big square.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And he's selling, and he's going to change the world mm-hmm. for small square hay production in Butler County. The machine's got about 100 sensors on it. It is incredible what it does, but it packs those things up in 14 bale bundles, and then it ties them with the twine that the big square balers use. So we have one of those in the county, and I'm excited to see what's happening. He's been planting some alfalfa. He's planted some crabgrass, and then cuts a bunch of mixed grass hay as well. But it changes the opportunity to have some small square hay available for folks that want to buy it, because they never touch it physically. You know, it goes out of the field with the Bobcat, and the days of, he told me the other day, they baled 1,300 square bales of hay and put them in the barn after lunch. I mean, that's rocking and rolling.
We always talk about how we hardly ever do a show what we don't get an idea about doing another show. We might need to go sit down with that guy one day and talk. I think it'd be interesting to learn a little bit more about.
Do you find that the market that he's shooting for is around Butler County, or is it outside of Butler County? And are they like horse people, or are they, you know, cattle folks, or what is the market he's trying to hit?
Well, he worked for years in Bowling Green. He was a machinist by trade and retired, and is farming, kind of like a lot of us have clients that do. But his mind is very mechanical. So feeding hay for his cows, he wanted to have some square hay for his cows, realized the limitations of labor to get it out of the field in a timely manner. So you make a really nice high-quality alfalfa crop and square bale it. That job ain't done. It's not safe till it's in the barn. And so Mike went to investigating this and studying on it, and he'd been selling a little hay, but he didn't want to sell much hay because he wanted to keep his best square bales for himself. But people kept talking to him, and it's going to go to the counties around us to begin with. He's not trying to be in the horse market. He's trying to be in the somebody wants a few for their calves, few for their sheep, but he's not trying to send semi-loads to horse country. He's going to sell some mixed hay to what we all call horse people. But another thing that I think it's going to change, we don't have much wheat in Butler County, so we have a hard time for our retailers to have wheat straw. So I think there's going to be some application for maybe Mike to find somebody to work with and bale up 10,000-15,000 bales of wheat straw and make that available. I don't know about your counties, but it is hard for us to find wheat straw, and it's hard for our retailers to find it.
It's the same for in Webster County. It's the same way.
Well, you got to be around wheat first. That's the first thing. Down in Christian County, where David and I live, there's quite a bit more wheat production, but even the vast majority, The highest percentage of that does not end up going into a bale. There's some wheat that's made down, some straw that's made down there, but not a lot compared to the amount of acres.
We've got one guy down there that is making these straw mats, you know, that you unroll.
Environmental mats,
That has put in a machine, and he bales not all of their straw that they raise, but he bales a bunch of it in the big squares, and then brings it in there, and they take that and shred it, and then make those straw mats out of it, those environmental mats. So, you know, it's all about the opportunities and the kind of the niche markets that our farmers want to get into. And I know you've seen that over the years. You've probably seen some niche markets that are not in existence anymore. You know, some things that have kind of gone by the wayside and different things like that. So, Greg, if you can think of something that maybe that kind of got started and is kind of not in existence anymore, what are some of those things that got rolling big and are not too big anymore?
Well, you know, you hurt somebody's feelings in this topic pretty easy, but since my since my Butler County folks probably can't hear your radio station, I'm going to tell it like it is.
Hey, we are on the internet in like 18 different countries, so I'm sure somebody.
Oh my goodness.
Somebody in Butler County is going to hear this. If we send them the link, you just tell me who to send it to.
Go and tell it.
I'm old enough to forget about the internet pretty regular. So Butler County was not a traditional tobacco county. Much of our upland soil was mined from the 40s going forward, so we never had a lot of tobacco base. Every county around me probably was raising 10 times the tobacco, but dark and burley, that Butler County did when I started. I think in 97 we had 500 acres of burley and 10 acres of dark, or something like that, just for reference.
And all that was probably air cured dark.
It was all dark air. Yeah. And you probably had growers in Christian County that raised 500 acres of tobacco on one farm.
Well, not quite, but I mean a lot. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So when the buyout hit and tobacco production began to go away on smaller farms and operations, it affected Butler County farms, but it affected far fewer of them. Mm-hmm. A lot of the people that were still raising tobacco took the buyout, stepped away, never came back, and weren't going to come back. So the need to diversify wasn't as big there. But we did have a round of the shrimp. Y'all probably mm-hmm. remember freshwater shrimp production. Mm-hmm. We had an operation put in just some of the like two spec from Kentucky State shrimp ponds could grow the shrimp, but couldn't sell it for enough to pay the feed bill.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was, we could grow shrimp in Butler County. I mean, we did a great job of it.
I remember something else that got big in several of our counties. I know it was in Ojai County, so it may have been Butler County as well, but the earthworms.
Yeah. Yeah, we had
those too.
We had a round of earthworms. I actually had a guy that mm-hmm. built a barn specifically for earthworms, spent $40,000, and it was so short that doesn't have a lot of other application.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So niche markets are really good, but you have to have a proven market. And just because we can grow earthworms and shrimp doesn't necessarily mean we should.
Yeah, right.
So as folks are looking to diversify, just because somebody tells you they got a market, and UK and y'all all went through it too, we do research before we kind of bless anything.
Mm-hmm.
And the worms was a great example of that. I mean, y'all probably took cussings in your office from people that thought you just didn't want to help them, because all I could say was, we cannot find an established market for these red wiggler earthworms. I am very hopeful that it works out, but our research scientists cannot find established markets. So, but I took several cousins and folks that thought I didn't want to help them over that. Those are the two that stick in my mind. Shrimp were better than earthworms because the growers could at least freeze them and eat them for a few years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, we had a guy probably produce 4,000 pounds of shrimp. 4,000 pounds of live shrimp is a lot mm-hmm. of live shrimp.
It is in Butler County.
Yeah, you better believe it. It might not be in Florida, but it is in Butler County.
I remember working with a lady called me to come out and look at their barn that evidently was very similar to the one you're talking about, because it was just a little less than 40,000 that it took to build it. She wanted to know what she could do with this barn now that the worms were a bust. And scrap metal was not what she had in mind, but there wasn't a lot else you could do with that building. And I tell you what she actually did, as ingenious as this was. David, I know, has seen a lot of Amish-built barns where they'll put up block walls 4 foot tall and then set a barn on top of it. She sold that barn to an Amish family, and that's exactly what they did. They come in, took it down, moved it to their place, and set it 4 foot higher than it was. Made it a little more usable then.
You know, that's just a good example of when you're trying to hit these new markets and kind of these niche markets is thinking ahead. You know, when we talked about the grain bin deal a while ago, when I had an example of that, and there were millions of dollars spent on a grain system, and you know, the forethought of how if they were to add bins to it, you know, was not given at all. It was just built. And then, I mean, it was so hard to make those other bins work into mm-hmm. that grain system. It wasn't even funny. They had to add some extra drags and some different pits just to make that work. So, you know, these niche markets are kind of like that. If you're going to give enough thought to that, think about what if it doesn't work out? What am I going to do if I'm having to build a structure?
What's my plan B?
Yeah. You know, yeah. What am I going to do if this doesn't work out? And I think a lot of times we talk about new markets and about niche markets and trying to be in that, but we don't always give enough thought to the fact that what if it doesn't work out? What am I going to do with that facility if it doesn't work out?
Yeah, 10-4, and that's sound advice. And, you know, it's fairly easy if somebody wants to grow a half acre of strawberries. They don't have to build a sorting house and all that stuff. But if somebody thinks they're going to grow 100 acres of squash, they're going to have to spend some money on infrastructure. So yep. Anybody exploring these niche opportunities or just alternative agriculture opportunities, like squash isn't a niche market, but it'd be a niche market in Butler County.
Right.
Ease into them with a little bit of caution and a whole lot of forethought, like you said, and and don't build facilities until you know that you have a need for them.
You know, folks, in any niche market, one of those things that I always try to remind people is it's okay to start small and ease your way into it. I had a lady a couple of years ago, it was right after the tornado, call me and said, hey, I'm fixing to order some strawberry plants. I've already committed to a certain amount. I just need to know some varieties. And so I started talking. I was actually out there at that warehouse where we had stuff stored. Vicki remembers this.
Yeah, I do.
And so I told the lady, I said, I've got to get to the office where I can look up some information, but I can get back with you. And she said, well, I need to know because we're ordering 3 acres worth.
Wow.
And I said, I asked her, I said, have y'all been farming a while? And she said, brand new to it. She said, my husband's in the military. And she said, we're using this as our transition plan. And I said, well, you know, I'm going to plant some strawberries next year too. I said, but I'm going to plant 50. And they went into it wholeheartedly, and they've made it 2 years now, but that's making it is a stretch.
Yeah.
Just because there's such a steep learning curve on any horticultural crop.
Well, and you get so overwhelmed.
Right, any size operation. They've gone down a much harder road than what they probably needed to. But they're making it.
I want to shift gears again and talk about another thing that I see emerging, and y'all probably do too. But we have got several cut flower farms that have begun. Some of them as a result of COVID, but we have one that's really getting large, and they had started before. But they did a great job. They started with a cut flower bed the size of about a semi. You know, they're taking up that much footprint.
Yeah.
And now they're up probably over a half acre of cut flowers. And what they're doing is they work with venues and photographers. And they sell cut flowers at the farmer's market, but they sell a ton of them to places where families are having special events.
Weddings is a big one.
Yeah. They do a lot of setup for weddings, setup for banquets, and they found a really neat niche. The gals are really creative, and they come off the most traditional farm in Butler County. They come off of the one dairy that we have there, but we're in the middle of a generation change on H&S Dairy. And we're seeing the next generation do things a little bit differently. But they're into cut flowers. They've started something called the Soaky Flower Exchange. And they're actually beginning to broker some flowers from other farms to florists and wedding venues and places. And I'm excited about the potential for that. Mm-hmm. But they've done it in a slow fashion. One of them was a horticulture major at Eastern. And they have slowly built this thing up, and they've got such a critical mass of demand that they're ready to work with some other farms.
And
Eastern's a good school, so I'm sure she'll go far.
I knew you'd like that, Jay.
And I think, though, if you go back and you look at businesses that have been successful, especially as far as agriculture and diversity and adding diversity to the operation and it growing, I think most of the time you'll see that the ones that are the most successful, though, they did start small, though. They started small, and then they grew over time. They did not start, like we were alluded to, too big, because then what happens is it tends to go the other way. Instead of growing, they start going the other direction because they get overwhelmed. They got in over their head. They couldn't do what they had in their mind that they was going to be able to do. So, but also I just wanted to, you know, you've been here for a while, as David said, we've all been here for a while.
It's okay to call me an old guy, Vicki.
Well, I'm old too. So I can say that. But over the years, you've been able to do a lot of different programs and be involved in a lot of different things, as all of us have. And that's the fun part too. But what is one of the most favorite program or most proud of program that you've been a part of over the years that you not necessarily that you hang your hat on it, but that it was just a special program that you will always, you know, be proud of?
Yeah, that one's an easy one, and it was done by the Mammoth Cave Ag Agents. There's 10 of us in the counties that surround Mammoth Cave that work together really well. And it was a time, it's probably been 15 years ago, but there was a ton of heat on animal agriculture. It seemed like we were getting a new animal agriculture regulation announced every day. It was on the news all the time. There were documentaries coming out about how dangerous our food system was and the recklessness with which our farmers raised their livestock, Food Inc., and all that stuff. And so in response to that, we worked on a ag leadership and advocacy program trying to recruit some farmers that were interested in telling the truth about agriculture, that were interested in being an advocate and how things were done in our part of the world. It was for farmers that didn't need to be away from their farm long enough to participate in the Kentucky Ag Leadership Program or the Farm Bureau Lead Program. We did it right in Bowling Green. And that thing, it was just really good. We brought in industry people, university people. We did communications training. We had the Farm Bureau communications training in. Guys come down, and they did mock interviews. And one I remember, I'll never forget, we had John Pettigo in the class, his family, big tobacco producer, big beef backgrounder. And the Farm Bureau interviewers were just trying to make them mad. They were trying to throw them off, you know, trying to make sure they were really ready to go give their message in media. And they asked him something about tobacco, about how tobacco was killing people. I don't know what all it was. But I could see the color coming in John's face. He got aggravated, but he got it back together, and he pulled an answer. And if we're going to work with ag advocacy, and all of us need to work with ag advocacy, we've got to train our leaders. You know, the media, they really don't want to talk to Greg and Jay. They want to talk to farmers. So we all need to have some farmers that we can point those to that are willing to talk to them. And some of that kind of training. But we called it the MEAL program, Motivating and Educating Agriculture Leaders. And we did it twice, and then I'm not sure why we got sidetracked, but that's probably the one that I think of in my whole career. It wasn't a grain production. It wasn't beef cows. It was agriculture leadership and advocacy. And a lot of those people are leaders in state organizations now. It's just really, really bared a lot of fruit.
Well, and that's something that we all need to do, whether we're on the farm, whether we're in an extension office, or whether we're working for an input dealer. Agriculture is our livelihood, and advocacy has to be part of that, because nobody else is going to get out and tell our story as good as we can.
That's exactly
and
right.
Preparing folks to get out and do that and be groomed and be cultured when they get in front of media outlets is certainly an important, worthwhile. So we're going to get ready and wrap things up. We always wrap things up with a timely tip. And knowing that this show is going to be aired in the middle of September, we felt like a good timely tip that you could help talk us about with us today would be grain handling safety. You know, folks are going to be working in and around. Once it leaves the field, it's in the truck, it's on the way to the bin. That's where that safety really needs to start, is on the road. But working in and around, climbing legs, getting down in bins, we felt like grain handling safety is just reminding folks to do their part to remain safe during their harvest.
Amen. Don't take the shields off. If you take the shields off to fix something, put them back. People get hurt when they're tired, you know, when it's not, you never hear somebody say, well, I knew that was going to happen, and I went ahead and did it anyway. You know, people get hurt because they're by themselves. They're going to do something real quick. They've done it 1,000 times, but they're tired and something goes wrong.
And they're busy.
Well, and we've talked.
They're busy at that time of year.
We did a safety show before, and you're exactly right. One of the things that I talked about at the time is folks always get hurt when they're doing familiar things. It's not when they're doing something for the very first time. That's when they're their most cautious.
Yeah.
But it's when you're doing that mundane, everyday activity, that's what's going to get you caught. So.
You know, we still fill a lot of grain bins with augers and swing-away augers. That drive line is still very dangerous. If, you know, you look down and there's some weeds in the auger, you can't reach and pick that up, let it go in the grain bin. Don't be out there by yourself if you can help it.
That's a big thing.
Huge thing. Drive over pits, whatever. It doesn't matter what it is. It is a dangerous time. And part of it, Vicki is right. We're tired. We're stressed. We got to get this unloaded, get back to the field, get one more load before dark or whatever. And then, heaven forbid, we have to get in those grain bins for something. A grain bin with grain in it has got to be as dangerous as a place as there ever is. Yeah,
absolutely. Yep.
Flowing grain is very dangerous. Yeah, just keep that in mind.
Well, Greg, we know we're going to wrap this up. We know you've got another place to be this afternoon, so we appreciate you being here with us and for this week's information. And thanks to our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.